Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, and it's time to talk taste. This is Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. Every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about food, but not really just about food. I hope sometimes we get deep into the question of taste, and we have with us today, back in the studio, two tastemakers of a handsome sort. They're waving at someone through the window right now.
That would be the chef of the restaurant, Mitchell.
That would be the chef of the restaurant. That restaurant would be Roberta's Brooklyn, onto which we're attached in a couple of shipping containers in what is probably the funkiest radio studio in the world. And I am joined by Adam Rappaport, the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine. Thank you for being back here, Adam.
Thank you, Mitchell.
And Andrew Knowlton, who is the restaurant and drinks editor, but you might know him better as the foodist, the BA foodist. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Thanks, Mitchell.
So it's our last show of the year. We aren't going to be on for a couple of weeks because of the way the holidays fall. And I thought, what better time to look back at 2012 and talk about foods that we've seen and eaten and tasted, and then look forward to what you guys are think is in store for 2013. You have brought the beautiful January issue of Bon Appetit magazine, which has top 25 food trends. But let's look back. What happened in 2012? What did you enjoy, Andrew, in your gallivanting around the world of restaurants?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing is going abroad right now. Still, Scandinavia is kind of this ripe place, Copenhagen.
Really?
And now it's starting to kind of even reach out into Stockholm and Oslo. I think the best meal I had this year was at a place in Oslo. It's actually a Finnish guy runs it, and the chef is Swedish, called Maimo, M-A-A-E-M-O.
Wow.
Are there any umlauts or like lines through the vowels?
No.
Or
Finnish, Swedish, and Norwegian? He's like all of Scandinavia in there.
And it was the most expensive place I've ever been with the, you know, Norway being, I think, the most expensive country in the world, and then just the currency
Tell
exchange.
Us. Yeah,
it was my wife and I. It was we did the. There's only one prefix,
and she's Norwegian.
She's
little,
Norwegian.
Little factoids.
And then you get
so you got the secret menu.
We got the secret menu, the secret lutefisk, and then you get the wine pairing. And I think, all told, you know, no extras, no supplements. And then when I saw the Amex bill, it was $1,200.
Holy shit!
I'm just gonna say,
and
this.
I did not expense that. By the way, paid out of my own.
Oh, yeah,
pocket. You could have eaten at Massa almost for that.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to curse on this show?
Of course, we're on the internet.
Don't ever get the fucking wine pairing, because like that it's insane how much more expensive your bill becomes. And
I couldn't agree with you more.
And it's like, you know what? I want a bottle that I like, and I don't need a different wine.
I expect that from him. I don't expect that from you.
I don't need
Mitchell.
A different wine with each course, and that's not how wine was designed. Yeah. Wine should be a little
bit
flexible.
But just for clarification, this is coming from a person who drinks Budweiser on ice and vodka and soda water on a regular basis. Just so I see where you're coming from.
I like to keep my palate clean and lean.
To say I'm with Rappaport here because I just find it overwhelming. Too many flavors. I get a little nauseous. By the 14th course.
Exactly.
I mean, if you're talking five courses, I can see five different wines.
I'm a fan of a white into a red. Like, and that's generally how the most, not, I mean, these days, who knows with restaurants that like they are now, but typically most, you know, multi-course menus are designed that you kind of segue from your vegetables and fish into your richer red meats. And it makes a bottle of white should be able to span more than one course.
How many courses did you have at this restaurant?
Well, it's the new thing, you know, the menu, when you get the menu, it's what, you know, seven or eight courses, but then you get this flurry of 12 bites at the beginning. So I think all told it was 29. And of course, you know, bread is now the new thing to do as a course, which they do at Blanca, right across at Roberta's in Blanca. So bread was a course, and rocks and
rocks smoking were, of course.
Thing, rocks, edible rocks.
So new. It is new Nordic.
It's totally new Nordic, and I like eating that way. I hope
that's N U with an umlaut.
Yeah.
So this year we saw that in trend come to New York and perhaps even outside at the Willows Inn I was at this year, although it's opened before. What do you think people are doing here to make it their own in America, the new Nordic American edition? Anything? Have you seen?
Well, I mean, I think they buy, I mean, so much of that new Nordic is about that evil word foraging that people seem to get sick of now, but there are, you know, you can see buckthorn and all these crazy ingredients that you get in the Scandinavian countries you don't necessarily get here. And, you know, going to this restaurant, Aska, A-S-K-A, which I think means charred or something in Swedish, which is in Williamsburg, that's very much that's neo-Scandinavian. I had a wonderful meal there and incorporating kind of American ingredients into that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about the plating and the homemade, the plates.
So describe it a little bit for us, just so people who haven't been to Aska or Noma might. What do you think it is?
I think it's nature-driven food. It's very, very subtle. I mean, I think the reason some people like it, it's almost like sushi to me. Like, there's a subtlety of stuff, and textures aren't sometimes a huge thing in that food.
Okay. So so subtle in flavor, not super spicy, not super fragrant,
I mean, you get those.
It's not,
you know,
pork belly on top of crackling.
No, it's not.
Right, with deep fried chili peppers. Pork, right.
You will get like a pork rind, I think, as a course. But no, it's very subtle. A lot of
not a lot of herbs that growing naturally in the Nordic countries.
So. Right. So you get a lot of, you know, pine needles and and it's almost like eating in a log cabin sometimes, that kind of food. And a lot of smoked stuff and, as we were saying, charred, people kind of blackening scallions or leeks.
We used to just call those things burn and throw them out, but now they wrap expensive beef in them and stuff.
Now they do.
So Rappaport, is this going to end up, do you think the pages of Bon Appetit are going to be full of home?
No.
No. Okay.
I mean, my issue is, I think that...
The January issue or a different issue?
Yeah. No. If you, and Dalton and I have talked about this, I think food like this, it's hard to pull off. Mm-hmm. You know, it's ambitious, it's creative, it's interesting, but is it delicious? Hmm. And I think a few chefs can manage to sort of bridge that gap.
I would have to say, personally, I the thing that surprises me about this new Nordic cuisine is it's more delicious than some of the previous trends in food that you expect.
When I was eating at Aska the other day, and I was actually annoyingly Instagramming some of the dishes, I started thinking, like, is this something that 20 years from now is going to be nouvelle cuisine when we're all making fun of ourselves? Like, I actually ate a broccoli spear that was upended, that was sitting in like an anchovy pine needle paste. Like, I'm probably gonna be making fun of my
Dirt's gonna be the raspberry vinegar, rye bread dirt will be the raspberry vinegar of the next 10 years. But do you think so? Part of the trends that sometimes we forget, restaurants are businesses and they have to stay, they can't serve you things you're going to cook at home at that point, because if they do, then you're just eat them at home. So isn't that part of a trend? Doesn't the fact that maybe they're trying to do things that, now that we all have sous vide machines at home and canisters.
They're trying to stay one step ahead.
Right.
And that's fine. It's like you go out. And I've always been adamant that you go out to eat for a different experience than you can get at home. We've talked about it, and I've been to your house for dinner a lot, Mitchell, and it's a good invite if you can get it, guys. When I go to friends' houses for dinner, I want home-cooked food.
Yes.
I want something homier and cozier. There's nothing that sort of irks me more than when you go to someone's house and they try to recreate a restaurant experience for you, and then dinner, you usually don't leave till 12:30. It goes on forever. The host is kind of stressed out and too meticulous, and it's okay for home cooking to be a very different experience. There's that piece in the Times about our dinner parties a thing of the past, and all the hostesses and hosts of the 70s and 60s. And you know, I forget who it was who had a quote in there, but it's like, you know what? Put out a big chicken pot pie and a big green salad and a bottle of wine, and you can't go wrong. Like, everyone at that table will be as happy as could be.
Grill a good piece of meat and stick it on some arugula, which I've experienced you doing.
It's exactly.
Very happy. Looking forward to it the next time.
So I think it's totally fine that when you go to a restaurant like Blanca, which is the adjunct, more sort of tasting laboratory here at Roberta's, that, it's great to have a very different experience and more ambitious and meticulous and precise. The question is, can they pull it off? And like I said, I think some, you know, the Rene Redzepi's of the world can. Other chefs try, and I think sometimes you get clever for clever's sake. And I've had experiences, and I've talked to Andrew about this, where it's like, okay, that's interesting, but I've sat through 17 course meals where there was not one thing that I was like, wow, that was delicious.
Right. Or that you can even remember.
Yeah.
If you liked.
But I do think that going out to eat, especially in the United States, has changed a little bit. Like for me, sometimes it's not about the body or like, yes, I'm hungry and I need nourishment. But mm-hmm. sometimes to me, I go out for the intellectual experience. It always doesn't have to be like a greasy burger or a party. Like, you know, do I want to eat like that every day? No, but like, you know, I don't, you know, it's just like going to the museum and looking at stuff that you might not love or something you might not hang on your wall at home, but you still need to go out and see it and eat it.
But
and
ultimately,
do it.
Capitalism wins out, and it's interest in the question. If it's good, people will come back. And if you look at in Brooklyn, when what's his name, Freeman's and Peel's, the restaurant in Williamsburg,
Marlowe?
No. The guy,
anyway,
Freeman's owner.
Issa.
And Issa, and what's his name? Who's the Freeman? Why am I blanking? owner of Freeman's.
Tavo.
That handsome,
anyway,
charming
sorry,
guy.
Yes,
yeah.
Hot Tavo. Anyway, so they opened Issa, and they went for this more sort of Scandinavian, much more aesthetic sort of thing going on there. And ultimately, it didn't work well enough. And
I know, and I was really bummed because I thought it was great.
Yeah,
but it worked, but Tavo shut it down because he wasn't feeling it,
but it wasn't work in terms of business. Like that place was not packed like you go into Freeman's or Peel's and they're serving basically comfort food and
but
liquor.
This is the reality of New York. We talk about this all the time in our office where you think New York is going to be the place where all these cutting edge trends begin. Mm-hmm. And that's true. You think about it in theater or in art. And in the reality of the economics here is you have to pay the rent and you have to please more people than that might
food
bring
along. You're right. Food-wise, it doesn't happen in New York. It happens design and space. Yeah. And right. That's where it happens.
Yeah, because running a restaurant, the profit margin is so slim, and it's so hard to. And you have to do good business, and you cannot stay in business if you're only sort of perpetrating an experimental, sort of avant-garde, you know, food. Because
so sad
to me. If people don't come back, you can't stay open.
And that's what's interesting about.
You could do that in other cities, if instead of Portland or something, where rent and whatnot is a lot more manageable.
Mm-hmm. But you can do it. You know, on that note. You know, when we did our top 10 restaurants in our September issue, one of those on there was Oxheart, which is in Houston, Texas, where, you know, known for Vietnamese food and some seafood, but not known for this kind of cutting edge cuisine. And they're doing it there. They're doing it in Austin. You know, they are doing it in these kind of secondary food markets.
I was at Catbird's in Nashville, which Nolan's a big fan of, and I had some issues with. But
I could have told you that before you went.
Yeah, you told me I was going to have issues with it. But it's about, you know, what, 20 seats at most around a sort of tasting bar.
Yeah.
But, you know, what they pay for rent there is probably like $20 a month. It's like they're in a house, like compared to what you have to pay for rent in Manhattan.
But you've just described a trend that I've noticed, and you've mentioned, we've referred to Blanca here, which is the 12-seat tasting bar.
Huge trend.
Mamafuku Co. was one. I know
Brooklyn Fair
is one. Atera is another. I know several chefs looking to open them because from the chef's perspective, what could be better than just cooking what you want,
one
menu for 12 people?
Which is funny, but it's also, this goes back, sushi bars have been doing that forever.
Exactly.
In Tokyo,
there
literally is, there's not just a sushi bar and then 50 seats, it's just the sushi bar.
Oxheart in Houston has that same thing, but you know, and even you could almost even say the Battersby in a way is kind of that because it's so small. But the question is, especially in New York, those restaurants don't make money. I mean, I'd be interesting to see if Blanca actually makes money. I doubt it does. How could it? Yeah.
Except maybe they do
two seatings a night that are guaranteed.
Now they do two seatings. They do.
Yes.
Ask Carlo.
The one thing, as Mitchell pointed out, when you are running a restaurant like that from a profit margin standpoint, you know exactly how many people are coming in. You know exactly how many portions you need, which is different than a regular restaurant. Like, hey, do we buy X number of wild salmons or do we need this many? Because maybe how many people are going to order the salmon? We don't know, but you're guesstimating constantly. With those prefix sort of preceded things, you know exactly what you need.
One of the funniest experiences I've had recently with food was going through the menu collection at the New York Public Library with René Redzepi and some of his friends. And what struck him most, once we got past the history that they had there, they couldn't believe how big the menus were, how many options there were. You know, he held open a Luchow's menu and was like, oh my God, like, how could they serve all these things? And I thought, every diner has a menu like that. Have you been to the corner? You know,
The diners are always crazy. Everything from like Greek specialties to meatloaf to pastrami.
It's good, but the expectation that you would have only one menu or 12 dishes is just so funny. That's changed.
We need to take René Redzepi to Cheesecake Factory and show him the menu
I'm sure he'd love it. I want to remind remind people, because I forgot to do this, who are listening, that if you have any questions about food trends in restaurants or at home or anything about Bon Appetit magazine or anything really about sports or whatever, we've got the experts here, 718-497-2128, or you can write us at info@heritageradionetwork.org or tweet us if you're listening to the podcast, or if you just prefer 140 character questions, at Taste Matters HRN. So let's go beyond New Nordic, which I think, you know, may, whether or not it spreads around the world and brings with it home cooks and all that, there has to be something else happening out there. Denmark and Norway and Finland are little countries.
Well, I mean, the specifically with New York, and I think it applies to the rest of the country too, is, you know, before, New York was a hard place to come to. If you had already had a restaurant in, say, San Francisco or London or Paris. And if you look at, like, Alain Ducasse and Robuchon and Gordon Ramsay, like, you know, major superstar mega chefs had such a hard time opening in New York.
That's right. But that's akin to, like, the hotshot pitcher or someone coming to the Yankees. It's like, this is New York. Don't come in here with your arrogance. And, like,
I know that. Know, but,
it's
like,
is it the people or is it the media? Because I feel like it's the media more than.
Well, sure. It's the same thing with the sports teams. Like, they give you a hard time. And there's some. It's not that they're out of town chefs, it's that there's European Michelin star chefs that we resent, that we're like, hey, okay, don't so, tell wait, us
well,
how to
well,
do let, it.
I got, yeah. Sorry, guys, I got to take a break, but we're going to get back to this because there's a lot going on about this conversation. Okay. You're listening to Taste Matters. We will be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Real Long Way to Go by Brothers NYC on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
We are on the air, gentlemen. Welcome back
just to
Taste Matters.
Just talking about Rick Ross, a man of big appetite.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. We're talking with Andrew Rappaport, editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine. And
did you say Andrew Rappaport? Who's my brother, ironically enough.
That's your brother, Adam Rappaport, who is the editor of Bon Appetit magazine, and Andrew Knowlton, who is the restaurants and drinks editor and the BA Foodist. Call us if you have any questions at 718-497-2128. And we do have a question that pertains a little bit to what we were talking about, but it's this role of media, and we were talking about the advent of the arrival of chefs from other places and whether or not they're accepted. And something happening in Toronto, which is my hometown, that involves my current place that I live here in New York, which I consider myself, depending on the conversation, a hometowner of thereof, is Dave Chang and Danielle Ballou have opened really high-profile restaurants in Toronto. And Danielle Ballou has been raked through the coals, and David Chang has been written about as the best restaurant in the city.
Well, this was my point when I brought that up about the European chefs coming in. We had three huge imports coming to New York City. We had Danny Bowen from San Francisco open Mission Chinese. Mm-hmm. We had Andy Ricker from Portland, Oregon open Pok Pok.
Yep.
And then we also had Matt Leitner from Portland, Oregon open Aterra, which have all been incredibly well received.
Indeed.
Media darlings. I mean, Danny Bowen, God bless that kid's soul, has no PR at all. And I think last month when you went to the newsstand, he was in probably seven magazines at one time. And he's in Playboy magazine.
Yeah, but the big difference is if you look at Pock Pock and Red Hook and you look at Danny Bowen's restaurant in downtown Chinatown-ish, Nolita, whatever, they're very New York places. They feel like Roberta's here. There's a very DIY ethos. They feel very right now and very New York, what's cool and hip, and New Yorkers are obsessed with Portland. And so they're very hip, cool places. When Alain Ducasse opened in the Essex House, there was something. It was just like the whole pen service. Here are six pens to choose from. Here are seven waters.
But a Terra is not DIY. Terra is as fancy schmancy as you can get, and people love it.
But it also gets at that whole tasting bar sort of thing, the little 10-seat bar. But I'm saying they're very on point. You know, Robuchon and Ducasse were not. They felt very foreign. They never felt like they were. They didn't feel like a part of what was cool in New York City.
Well, to those moneyed people in the Upper East Side and Upper West Side, the fact that the chef of the century can come to New York and not succeed, to me, is incredible. And then,
but a restaurant is much more than a chef. It's got to be the feel. And Pock Pock feels New York. Danny Bowen's restaurant feels like New York. Even a Terra. Alain Ducasse's restaurant was so weird in the Essex House.
Sorry, guys, but Thomas Keller came back to New York and opened a place that doesn't really feel like New York per se. And
that's a good
people
point.
People love it.
Some people love it.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to.
You don't see many New Yorkers always in there, I have to say.
Well, that's another good point. Yeah. And I think what's interesting, but at least on that high end scale, it's interesting to explain Keller, but you know, I think one reason Nolan and I were talking about Danielle Ballou on the way over, and when he opened Danielle, and we talked about how he named the restaurant Danielle, and we're talking about restaurants, chefs naming restaurants after themselves, and part of it's a French thing, but part of it is also when he left Le Cirque, he was already a hugely popular figure among the Upper East Side crowd from his years at Le Cirque and getting 4 stars. So when he opened his place, he already had a huge built-in loyal following.
Sure.
Ducasse or Robuchon had no loyal following. They weren't regulars, and Danielle would cater to regulars and make them the food they wanted, even if it wasn't on the menu.
Some ways, Thomas Keller was a homecoming, and everyone always loved him here, but he never could make a success somehow, you know, or it took him some time, so he came back as a success.
Yeah, and so I just think those two guys, and Ramsay also, like, they had no relationship to New York, and they opened restaurants that didn't particularly feel New Yorkish, whereas...
Guy Fieri also.
Yeah, instance, you know. Right? So I think, it's a nuanced answer, but I do think
But are we looking forward to anyone coming to New York that you know of?
My in-laws are coming for Christmas Eve and Christmas night.
Do they make a good brisket or something?
No, but we're making pierogi on Christmas Eve. So they can do the non-meat thing, so that'll
be
fun.
Any chefs we know are coming to New York?
I don't think any. I mean, I'm sure there are a few that have some plans that are coming to New York. I've heard rumors of some ideas, some people tossing around. But I think it's so intimidating for these chefs to come to New York.
Just they all want to.
They all want to. I mean, you want to be... You want to be Madison Square Garden. You want to play on the best court, you know. But it's money wise. I think it's
More point comparing it to sports. Yes. If you come in like Danny Bowen or Andy Ricker and you spend $48 to open your restaurant with corrugated tin siding and stuff, the expectations are lower. If you come in with the guy with the $20 million contract, you're going to get a lot more focus and a lot more criticism, fairly or unfairly.
Well, but Pock Pock came with a lot of. You know, anticipation.
Well, a lot of anticipation, but that space is so, like, you walk in, it completely puts you at ease.
What this adds to this, but last week we had the director of the New York Food Truck Association on, and he said that every single food truck that has gone bricks and mortar is still open. Nothing's closed. And he feels like...
In New York, you're saying.
In New York, of the food truck world. You know,
like the which ones
truck
are those?
And,
Schnitzel truck?
I don't know if they have a bricks and mortar.
They do.
Place?
Yeah. They
like,
did.
No one. So they were talking. He was talking about it. David was talking about it in the. David Weber is his name. He was talking about it as an idea of an incubator. And he's like, you learn how to do business on the street. You know, it's like dog eat dog, and you have to pare it all down. And when you open, you have that following you were talking about.
Well, something like Mud Truck. There used to be a Mud Truck by my old apartment, and I'd go there every morning. They were always cool people who worked there, and I just liked their vibe.
So this idea of having a context for what you're doing and not just plunking down in the middle. I don't know. I mean, if we had the secret to success in a restaurant, we wouldn't be here talking about them. We'd actually be running them.
And the treats truck thing also succeeded because there's a brick and mortar place near me. I mean, I think the other thing that is interesting on that kind of truck is I know pop-ups are kind of old school, but they actually in LA and I think Portland and Chicago, they actually are great incubators to see if, I don't know if a concept sticks or if you want to get into it. There's a great place in downtown LA called Alma, which was a pop-up. and Wit Bricks and Mortar, and it's a husband and wife team. And, you know, I can't wait to go. I haven't been. I've heard amazing things, and that will definitely be in contention for 2013 restaurant, top 10 restaurant of the year for us.
Well, look at Brisket Town, which had a whole, you know, community of people who would order briskets in advance, and now he's open. There's a line around the block. I mean, it's only 20 days
old. Is that a Bruce Springsteen song?
Brisket Town. Yeah, I love it. Okay, we have two questions. This is an exciting day for us. and let's look at the first one, which we've been talking about a little bit, but since it's the trend show, more or less, we haven't talked about that many trends, but what does media follow them or make them happen? What's the relationship of media to the trends?
I think you've got to follow them. I think, you know, we notice what, you know, hey, in the next issue, tater tots, for instance, everyone's doing them. So you sort of put them into focus, and you give the list, and you give it a cool photo, and then all of a sudden other people jump on and kind of sort of take it to the 2.0 level. But it's got to be happening out there first. It's not our job to sort of create trends in general, I think. Right. Knowlton?
Well, no, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think if you eat out enough and you travel to the U.S. and the country, I think certain themes, how those themes start, I'm not sure, but there are certain things. And I do think sometimes we can push a trend along by you know, if it is like a grain mill, you know, people making their own grains.
That's
at
in the
home.
New issue of January Bonus.
And I have been coveting that grain mill since I saw it in Denmark years ago.
It is amazing.
To make your own flour.
It's a cool $500. But no, but I
can't,
you know,
believe it's in the issue.
Yeah. I mean, you just notice. I mean, I will say it's interesting, you know, when we look at other food magazines or other, even if it's like a GQ, just any kind of pop culture magazine, that you kind of notice the same trends, and you see them sometimes in other magazines, and then sometimes they see things that I wouldn't have noticed, and I think mm-hmm. we see. So, you know, I think it's kind of chefs have a lot to do when it comes to ingredients, and we see that, and then other times it's, you know, I think partly us and media that kind of pushes.
Do social media play a role these days?
Well, yeah, Twitter, hugely, because if someone tweet that. Well, the thing is, but I think that the litmus test is what kind of pickup do you get? There are certain tweets when you put a tweet out there that strikes a chord, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden everyone pounces on it. And I think with our job in terms of it's knowing which trends have legs and then writing about them. And I used to at GQ for 10 years and work looking at fashion, and you would see all sorts of stuff on the runway every 6 months. But it was like your job to zero in on the ones that guys would actually get into and realize that, you know what? I remember 10 years ago, I was like, wow, the suits are looking really short on the runway these days.
Right.
We should do something on how the suit jacket's getting shorter. And this was 10 years ago. Now you look at, I mean, suit jackets are basically waiter jackets. I mean, they're right at the waist. These sleeves, you used to always say, like, you should bear the length of the jacket should kind of come towards the tip of your fingertips. Now the short suit jacket that's gone a bit much is actually shorter than your sleeves. It's on your waist right, like a jean jacket.
It looks like your high school, your bar mitzvah jacket.
Exactly. Okay. So but the point being is like that's something like you notice and you're like, this is going somewhere. This is happening. And,
right.
And same thing with food, to sort of recognize which ones are going to have legs and are going to get pickup. And you write about those and sort of ignore the other stuff that's sort of trying too hard.
And I think we sometimes forget also that trends come from the consumer, but I feel like chefs move them. What interests chefs become trends. You know, molecular gastronomy was really exciting for a lot of people, and to the extent that people wanted to eat it, it became a trend because they wanted to do it. And, you know, you're always looking to be entertained. It can be a very boring job to cook thing every day in the kitchen.
I always wonder if, you know, like a mad food symposium, which happens every year in Copenhagen that mm-hmm. Renee puts on, of course, you know, Mitchell, you know, do they get ideas there? Do they get ideas from each other? Like, I don't know why sea buckthorn, something I hadn't heard of years ago, is now making its way. Right. Now
it's
they're
pretty
selling.
Delicious.
It's all branding. It's just got a cool name.
It's got a cool name.
But now they even sell like this elixir that's supposed to be, you know, rich
in
antioxidants.
Yeah, it's in cream. We brought back creams for just because we thought it was hysterical.
And like, I don't know. Like, I'd love to know sometimes who decided, all right, pretzels have been around forever. You can buy a dirty pretzel on the streets in New York City, but now we're going to do all these crazy pretzels, you know.
Well, Stork's Bakery in Whitestone, Queens has amazing soft pretzels.
Do they
have to go?
All
right. Yeah. All right. Okay, one more question, and we are slowly running out of time. Quickly running out of time. I don't even totally understand this question, but maybe you guys will because you're hipper than I. Who are the Kevin Bacons of today's food world? I.e., what spots or groups are turning out the country's top chefs? So who have you been with?
Six degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Those incubators.
So obviously there's Scandinavia, Rene Redzepi, and his the next generation's already taken hold there. in restaurants, people from his kitchen. But do you see other pockets? You mentioned Nashville. Is something going on in Nashville? Or is it just...
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those southern towns have a lot going on. I mean, I think...
Are there any chefs, like, big-name restaurants that have spawned, like, the current generation of, like, the Danny Bones of the world or whatnot? That
well,
all
I mean,
guys...
I think now you're starting to see a lot of the Momofuku guys who work there start right. to do their things, the incubators. Like, you know, at one point in Kraft's Kitchen, Tom Colicchio's restaurant, there was... you know, seven or eight guys who right. now are extremely successful.
There are some, but I wonder, so Momofuku would be one, partly just because it's gotten so big, there are so many different pieces.
Yeah, I mean...
There was the River Cafe, there was Le Cirque, there was L'Espinasse, there was Kraft, and then...
Danielle
who
had
is
a lot
now?
Of
yeah.
I mean, I think Manresa out of Los Gatos, California, cool. they do an amazing job. I think, I think Meadowood is putting out people. I mean, the unfortunate thing that happens now is I don't think... A lot of these chefs are staying very long in their if you're not the executive chef, you do a stage and then you kind of move on. I think it's like a 6 month to a year thing, and people aren't doing their
to really learn. It's amazing how many chefs work at a restaurant for 4 months and they open their own place and they say worked at Danielle blah blah blah. And yeah. It's like right. you were like. An assistant, in your garde manger for a few months, and
I'm sure you have an intern or two at Bon Appetit who have that on their resume.
Yeah. It's funny, but then every blog and magazine picks up on that and say, right. "Former Danielle chef," and like, right. well, kind of,
Yeah, we walked through the door. We had dinner there.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well, guys, it's always a pleasure to have you here chatting as though no one's listening to our conversation, which is the fun part about radio on the internet. People are listening. We're just cited in, I can't say it, but I will, Sever Magazine's Top 100. The radio station's one of the 100 best things in the food world these days. We won't be on for the next 2 weeks, and when we come back on January 9th, we have a really interesting show, the first time we're taking it out of the studio to the new exhibit of food, Our Global Kitchen, at the American Museum of Natural History, where we're walking through with the curator, Mark Norell, and it's really exciting. If you haven't been in the meantime, go do your homework, check out the exhibit. Thank you. We'll be back in 2013 talking about taste, see where it takes us. In the meantime, eat something delicious, subscribe to Bon Appetit magazine.
Thank you, Mitchell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.